Well, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. President Donald Trump has declared Obamacare essentially dead after the House of Representatives narrowly passed a Republican-crafted health care replacement Thursday. After the vote, House Speaker Paul Ryan touted what he said the bill will do.
It makes health care more affordable. It takes care of our most vulnerable. And it shifts power from Washington back to the states and, most importantly, back to you, the patient.
But House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, in a counter news conference following the vote, said it will do the opposite and give large tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans.
The public will now see what they gave their name to. They put their name next to you're paying more for less. And we'll make sure that the public is aware of that.
The bill sets aside billions of dollars more to help people afford coverage, but experts say that money is unlikely to guarantee an affordable alternative for people now covered under a popular provision of the existing law that prevents insurers from rejecting them or charging higher rates based on their health. A few hundred protesters lined up on Thursday along Manhattan's West Side Highway in New York to jeer Donald Trump's motorcade as he made his first trip home to New York since becoming president of the United States. Trump sped by on his way to attend a dinner with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull aboard the USS Intrepid, a decommissioned aircraft that is now a museum. Some supporters of Trump were also on hand to cheer him on. The protest wasn't nearly as large as some have been since the president was elected. This is VOA. In a surprise announcement Thursday, the White House said President Trump's first overseas stop will be to Saudi Arabia, where he'll meet with leaders from numerous Muslim nations to discuss a coordinated ideological campaign against radical Islam. The trip is scheduled for later in May.
My first foreign trip as President of the United States will be to Saudi Arabia, then Israel, and then to a place that my cardinals love very much, Rome.
The task of the United States, President Trump added, is not to dictate how others live, but to build a coalition of friends and partners who share the goal of fighting terrorism and bringing safety, opportunity, and stability to the war-ravaged Middle East. Former President Barack Obama unveiled plans for his future presidential library and museum on the south side of Chicago, where he raised his family and launched his political career. The designs show a complex of modern buildings with a library, museum, and event center, plus a community garden, a children's play area, and potentially an athletic field.
The best things that have happened to me in my life happened in this community. The closest friends that I have made, the start of my life in public service, the values that I learned here in Chicago and that we've now passed on to our children. I owe it all to this community.
Flanked by drawings and renderings, Obama also announced that he and former First Lady Michelle Obama will be donating $2 million to fund a Chicago summer jobs program. The museum, the tallest of the three buildings, will hold exhibition space, public spaces, offices, and education and meeting rooms, according to the Obama Foundation. They're also considering overseeing the project. We'll look into the possibility of locating a Chicago Public Library branch on site. Allegations of fake news and hacking attempts dominated France's tense presidential campaign Thursday. With just 2 days left for independent Emmanuel Macron and his far-right rival Marine Le Pen to win over voters before Sunday's high-stakes runoff, Paris prosecutors launched a preliminary investigation Thursday into whether fake news is being used to influence the voting, as frontrunner Macron and populist Le Pen rallied thousands at their last big campaign events in opposite parts of the divided country. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The former Guinean mines minister has been found guilty in the United States for mortgaging his country's resources to the Chinese.
We should be very thankful to the American authorities for taking that issue very seriously. If that can give a lesson to others who are still in office and who are doing exactly the same thing.
Fayamili Muno is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. The lawyer for former Mines Minister Mahmoud Tiam says he will appeal Tiam's conviction. The Nigerian military says it has killed several Boko Haram militants in its latest offensive, and Kenya takes steps to avoid a repeat of the deadly 2007 post-election violence during the August poll.
The successful management of election petitions by the Kenyan judiciary was one of several key factors responsible for the relatively peaceful elections and transfer of power here in this country in 2013.
Irene Khan is the Director General of the International Development Law Organization. A new report looks at how the Trump administration can combat kleptocracy in Africa, and concerns grow over policing of social media in Uganda. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The lawyer for former Guinean Mines Minister Mahmoud Tiam says he will appeal his client's conviction for mortgaging Guinea's natural resources. A New York jury convicted Tiam this week of laundering $8.5 million that he received in bribes from a Chinese conglomerate. In return, and according to prosecutors, Tiam, who served as Guinea's Minister of Mines and Geology between 2009 and 2010, gave the Chinese conglomerate exclusive and valuable investment rights in various sectors of the Guinean economy. Prosecutors also said Tiam abused his position to enrich himself by purchasing a $3.8 million estate in New York and sending his children to private schools. But Tiam's lawyer, Erin Goldsmith, says prosecutors failed to present enough evidence to prove the crime of bribery.
Well, we're deeply disappointed in the jury's verdict. We feel there was not enough evidence to actually prove the bribe, because he was only charged with the laundering of money. But in order to convict, they needed to prove the underlying crime, which would have been a bribe. We feel that there was certainly not enough evidence to prove that there was a bribe that happened at all. As a result of that, we're going to be filing a motion to overturn the verdict. And if that is not successful, then after his sentence, we will be seeking an appeal.
So what do you make of the accusation he was charged with using his official position as Minister of Mines for Guinea to facilitate the award to the Chinese conglomerate of exclusive and highly valuable investment rights in various sectors of the Guinean economy?
Well, there was no evidence of a quid pro quo, meaning there was no evidence that he had the ability to do something or not do something for the Chinese conglomerate in order to get into the investment project that it did with the Republic of Guinea at the time. And in fact, the witnesses who testified for the prosecution, who were members of the Guinean government at the time, did not have any evidence or any direct knowledge as to whether or not Mr. Tiam ever engaged in inappropriate activity.
The accusation is that he used the money that he laundered from the bribery to buy a multi-million dollar estate in Dutchess County and to pay for private schools for his children. Does he have a multi-million dollar house?
He does not. The house was purchased by a business partner of his for that corporation as an asset. Mr. Tiam paid for a number of the renovations that were done on the house because he was going to be using the house as a tenant, but he did not, in fact, purchase the house.
Looking at the release here, the maximum sentence for this kind of crime that he has been convicted for is 10 years in prison. What do you make of that?
Well, based upon the federal system, what we have is guidelines that are drafted by the legislature, and Those guidelines, if you look at the funds or the value of the funds that were allegedly laundered, then his sentence would probably wind up somewhere around 8.5 or 9 years.
So where is Mr. Thiam now?
Mr. Thiam is in New York, and he is being held until sentencing.
Mr. Goldsmith, I am also originally from Africa, and too often we hear of government officials abusing their positions and this whole issue of corruption. But you don't think your client is guilty of this crime?
I don't. I think, unfortunately for Mr. Thiam, he agreed to go in and help a government that was temporary, had a tremendous amount of both governmental and civil unrest at the time. So there was a lot of unknowns. And the Chinese conglomerates have over time been shown to have taken advantage of a lot of countries that were unstable, particularly in Africa. That's unfortunate for those African countries. And it's unfortunate for those unstable governments where these very, very wealthy Chinese conglomerates were coming in and taking advantage of them. But I think it's also important to remember that at the time, Guinea was cash-strapped. It had very little cash available to run its operating budget, and the conditions in the country in terms of infrastructure were awful for its citizens. So while there is a shadow of corruption that surrounds the time and the place, and certainly a number of players involved, I don't think that I've seen enough evidence and that enough evidence was presented to the jury to show that Mr. Thiam himself was involved in any wrongdoing.
Mr. Goldsmith, thank you very much for speaking with us here at the Voice of America and on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Aaron Goldsmith is the lawyer for former Guinean Mines Minister Mahmoud Thiam. He was speaking with me from New York City. A Guinean opposition leader is welcoming the conviction of former Guinean Mines Minister Mahmoud Thiam for laundering $8.5 million that Thiam received in bribes from a Chinese conglomerate. Prosecutors at Thiam, who served as Guinea's Minister of Mines and Geology between 2009 and 2010, gave a Chinese conglomerate exclusive and valuable investment rights in various sectors of the Guinean economy in exchange for money. Guinean President Alpha Conde says he has made transparency in the mining sector a priority of his administration. But Faya Milimuno, leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea, says it is still business as usual. He hoped Thiam's conviction would serve as a good lesson for other Guinean government officials who are still doing exactly the same thing.
It is a very good news for Guinean people because that is the way this country is being sold by the government members. We should be very thankful to the American authorities for taking that issue very seriously. If that can give a lesson to others who are still in office and who are doing exactly the same thing, I would say it's emotional, you know.
You say this is the way the country is being sold, but I thought that under President Alpha Conde that the country's resources are being protected.
It is not the case. It's exactly the same thing that is going on. Even now, we have a lot of companies coming, having contracts with the government, and the country is not benefiting absolutely nothing. So it is a good thing to give some lessons to those who are still in office. The situation has not changed.
So you as an opposition, are you pushing to make sure that the Guinean people understand how their resources are being used?
Yeah, we've been actually denouncing every single day what is going on here. And what is happening now on the United States side, you know, it is the way of siding, you know, those people who are abandoned by their own government, taking the country resources and using them for themselves and their families. So having on our side a government of the United States and other countries, it will be helpful. On the opposition side, that is what we've been denouncing for decades now. The bad thing is it is not changing. We had a lot of hope that Alpha Conde in office, the situation will get better. But I will say it is even worse today.
Faya Milimuno is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with me from the capital, Conakry. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 5th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A Nigerian military spokesman says ongoing air bombardment of suspected Boko Haram militants' hideouts has killed several terrorists and wounded many others. Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Osman says the air assault also destroyed Boko Haram weapons. But critics say the lofty narrative often released to the public by the Nigerian military is not a true reflection of the issues on the ground. They argue that insecurity in parts of the country's northeast caused by Boko Haram has contributed to the sharp food shortage residents in those areas are currently experiencing. Brigadier General Usman tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the accusations are without merit.
The military has involved itself in what we call Operation Give Punch. The essence of it is just to clear the remnants. Boko Haram hibernations in various border towns and other bushes surrounding the Sambisa forest. As a result of that, the Air Force were able to carry out some air interdiction, and their bombardments were with utmost precision to the point that quite a number of key Boko Haram terrorist leaders were killed and some of them have been injured. But what we are doing now, we are continuing with the clearance operation, and whatever we are able to confirm is through regards to the details, we'll definitely let you know.
Critics of the military action are saying that despite what you have said, Boko Haram militants are still holding sway and that their activities have prevented aid agencies from accessing places where there is food shortage, and that what the army is saying is not true. What do you say to that?
Rather, it is the other way around. What they were alleging is not true, because I would like anybody to tell me which part of the northeast that is not accessible to the, you know, caregivers or the humanitarian agencies. Just tell me one. But invariably, let me tell you, it is not correct. Even though people point to, you know, the isolated suicide bombing attempts, which are usually intercepted, as a pointer to that kind of insecurity. And usually, mostly, it is even at the metropolis, the suburbs of Maiduguri, not the other parts of the, you know, the northeast.
Critics are saying that the army comes out to give very lofty statements saying that they have cleared Boko Haram remnants and that are not a threat anymore and that they have lost their edge, weapons and all that. Yet these Boko Haram militants carry out occasional attacks on armies and villages, burn them down, take their cattle, take their food and all that. That the army should be transparent to tell Nigerians what is really happening on the ground rather than paint a rosy picture of what is not happening. What do you say to that?
I can tell you with utmost sense of responsibility, whatever we have been doing has always been the truth and transparent and verifiable, because it is not just the army that is operating on the ground. The other armed forces are there and security agencies and, of course, other stakeholders, notably the civilian JTF. And, of course, the good thing about it is that we have a lot of humanitarian agencies operating in the various parts of the Northeast that you can verify such information. So it is not correct for anybody to say that we give lofty stories. It is not true. And the agencies wouldn't have been able to carry out their humanitarian activities if what we are saying is not correct.
Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Osman is the spokesman for the Nigerian military. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. A new report by the Council on Foreign Relations looks at how the Trump administration can combat kleptocracy in Africa. John Campbell, a fellow at the Council and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, talks to Ricky Stryak about how corruption has fueled terror groups such as Boko Haram. He says the United States should make better and more coordinated use of the tools for countering kleptocracy, such as combating international money laundering. He specifically urges the U.S. embassies be more proactive in revoking visas for people for whom there is credible evidence of involvement in kleptocracy.
Kleptocracy is directly related to international crime on the one hand. Kleptocracy and crime together can have a relationship with international terrorism. In other words, international terrorism very frequently funds itself through activities such as kidnapping, bank robberies, and so forth, which kleptocracy encourages the relevant authorities to look the other way.
You mentioned in the piece that domestic anti-corruption campaigns are underway in Nigeria and South Africa. How important is it that anti-corruption campaigns are led domestically and not seen as an intervention from a foreign power?
It's extremely important. And if the anti-corruption campaigns are to be successful, they essentially have to originate and come out of the country that is directly involved. That said, outside countries can provide assistance, but the leadership has to come from within. An interesting thing about the difference between Nigeria and South Africa is that the anti-corruption campaign in Nigeria is led by the president. In other words, it's led from the very top and by the government. In South Africa, it is primarily led by civil society. I would suggest that in South Africa, while it is more diffuse, because it is led by civil society, it is probably deeper.
Could you talk about a brief overview of kleptocracy in Nigeria as we know it now, post-colonial Nigeria?
Obviously, when you're talking about kleptocracy, statistics are usually lacking because you're talking about criminal or quasi-criminal behavior. Beyond that, African statistics in general are very often incompletely developed. So we have to be very careful about efforts to over-quantify kleptocracy. I think the best way to think about kleptocracy is, if you like, it's kind of like obscenity. It's hard to define, but you know it when you see it.
How has kleptocracy fueled in Nigeria a group like Boko Haram, where their origins were against the ruling class?
I mean, that's right. I mean, one of the things that Boko Haram is, and it's a whole lot of things, most of which are quite terrible, but one of the things that Boko Haram, one of the drivers of Boko Haram, has been public disgust at the levels of corruption, and particularly levels of corruption amongst the traditional elite.
John Campbell is a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria and Africa expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from New York City. Logistical challenges and disputes during Kenya's primaries last month have raised concerns about the nationwide polls in August. How can the country avoid a repeat of the deadly post-election violence in 2007? Rayel Ombua reports from Nairobi.
When poll results are contested, the final decision often lies with the courts. It is a hefty responsibility, said Irene Khan, the Director General of the International Development Law Organization.
Electoral cases cannot be treated in the same way as other matters that come before the courts because of their inherent political sensitivity, the high public interest in their outcomes, the intense bursts in which electoral petitions are filed, and the short time limits within which they have to be dispensed.
The International Development Law Organization, along with Kenya's judiciary, released recommendations ahead of the elections in August. It will be a massive polling exercise. Kenyans will be voting in local, parliamentary, gubernatorial, and presidential races. Political tensions have been climbing since last year over the organization of the upcoming polls. Disputes over the results of the 2007 elections killed more than 1,000 people. But Khan says there is reason to be optimistic this year.
In an environment marked by ethnic tensions and low public trust in political institutions that had triggered the post-election violence in 2007, the successful management of election petitions by the Kenyan judiciary was one of several key factors responsible for the relatively peaceful elections and transfer of power here in this country in 2013.
The report says 188 petitions were filed in 2013, challenging the results of those polls, but the court managed to finalize all the disputes within the mandated six-month period. The judiciary is prepared for issues that may arise in August, said the Kenya's Director of Public Prosecutions, Keriako Tobiko, in a statement read by his secretary, Dorcas Oduor.
The Director of Public Prosecutions has put in place measures to to deal with electoral offenses, which include the constitution of a team of 105 prosecutors to be active in electoral offenses. They have been trained and they are spread all over the country in all the 47 counties and 120 court stations. The Director of Public Prosecutions again has put in place a 24-hour call center that is manned by prosecutors, and this call center is also a secretariat that acts as a rapid response team to all electoral offenses.
The International Development Law Organization says a strong dispute resolution system is key to avoiding violence and ensuring the legitimacy of results, but voters must understand the system.
Electoral justice should not be restricted to elites or well-resourced petitioners, but must be made available to all those who feel disenfranchised and excluded. And here the judiciary plays an important role in its public outreach activities to inform and to engage.
Lack of faith in the independence of the judiciary remains a challenge. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the latest FIFA ranking released on Thursday, which places the Pharaohs of Egypt as the best team in Africa for the fourth consecutive time. The Pharaohs, however, occupies the 19th spot on the world ranking. The North Africans are followed by Senegal in second place and Cameroon occupying the third spot on the continent. Burkina Faso is in fourth, ahead of Nigeria, who are unmoved at number five. Congo DR is sixth, Tunisia is seventh, Ghana is eighth, Ivory Coast is ninth, while Morocco wraps up the top 10. And to South Africa, where the South African Football Association, SAFA, have appointed Stuart Baxter as the new coach of their national team following an announcement on Thursday. The 63-year-old returns for a second spell in charge of Bafana Bafana, having previously led the side during African Zone qualifying for the 2006 FIFA World Cup in Germany. He replaces Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba, who was dismissed back in December. Farouk Khan is a member of the SAFA selection committee, and he says Stuart Baxter is the right man for the job.
I think Stuart's record speaks for itself, both at club level. I think when he was involved with Bafana, he didn't have a bad run. That Stuart's also his knowledge of local football was very important to us.
Baxter will transition into the role once he completes his current duties as coach of SuperSport United after the South African Football Association reached an agreement with the South African club to acquire the services of a former Finland coach.
There were some candidates that had a lot of experience, that had a fantastic track record, but they struggled in other areas of local knowledge and knowing what local footballers were about, etc.
Staying with coaches, former Egyptian national team manager Hassan Shahata has confirmed that he was approached by Nigeria and Ghana, but the negotiations broke down. The 69-year-old has parted ways with Petrojet after losing 1-0. Shahata led Egypt to three consecutive African Cup of Nations. Head coach of Nigeria's beach soccer team, the Supersign Eagles, Aldo Ejo, has been explaining the reasons behind Nigeria's ouster from the 2017 FIFA Beach Soccer World Cup in the Bahamas. The head coach said the shoddy preparations of his team was responsible largely for their poor showing at the competition.
All we need is good preparation, not fire brigade preparation or assist to go.
Former Stoke and Tottenham Hotspur striker Gareth Crooks has urged all black players in Italy not to play this weekend unless Sule Muntari's ban is lifted. The former Ghana international was booked for dissent when he asked the referee to stop the Serie A game against Cagliari, protesting against being racially abused. Sule Muntari is to serve one game ban after being sent off against Cagliari for leaving the pitch after being racially abused. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that's it for this Friday, May 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.